Should women wear head coverings in church? 1 Corinthians 11, that is a tough passage. And a lot of people have struggled with it for years. And there's been a rise of head coverings in churches, not only conservative, but also reformed churches. And should we be taking this passage literal? How should we understand it? Well, today I bring Doug Van Dorn onto the podcast because he has a new book out actually walking through this passage. And I think it's important that we listen to what he has to say because one, we're going to learn about how to interpret hard passages. And two, learn how to use context and culture to understand this particular passage. So stay tuned.
Most Christians that I meet, they're not reading their Bibles because they're not interested in it or in Jesus. It's frustrating. It's confusing. We often get lost. I myself have felt that for many years. The Bible according to Jesus was written to help people understand the point of the Bible, which we're not hiding. It's about Jesus. How to understand the Old Testament law and the covenants and the promises and the prophecies. Hopefully this is helpful for you and will encourage you to read your Bible more. You can grab a copy of this new book at theocast.org.
Welcome to another episode of Theocast. I'm your host, John Moffitt. I am the pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee. And I'm going to pause for a moment because people skipped the intro and I had a guy visit my church who said he had been in the area for 2 years and had no idea my church was there. I'm in Spring Hill, Tennessee. There we go. If you didn't hear that, hopefully you hear that. Grace Reformed Church. If you'd like to learn more about the ministry, you can go to theocast.org, and a lot of articles and materials and a community that's there that's growing. I've got two new classes that are available for those who are in the community and a new book on how to study the Bible. You can learn more about that at Grace Reformed Church. Sorry, no, you can at theocast.org. It's been a while. All right. Very first time not to do a podcast together. But first time on Theocast, Doug Van Dorn is with us today. And it's like my brain doesn't know where to go. Like, are we doing Reformed Fringe? Are we doing Theocast? What are we doing here? So we are on Theocast first time. And we've been wanting to bring Doug on for, we could have brought you on for your baptism book, your covenant theology book. So we're going to bring you to do a new book, a book that's not even out yet. So
Doug, it'll be out by the time we... this airs. We'll see.
Well, yeah. What I mean is your baptism book is how many years old? That's what, 10 years old?
That's like 17 years old.
Oh, 17. There you go. And then your covenant theology, how old is that one?
That's like 15 years old.
There you go. That's my point. It's a newer book. Let's just put
it
that way.
I'm an old man.
Yeah, but I got more gray hair than you do. So we won't do ages here. So Doug Van Dorn, who's the pastor of the Reformed Baptist Church in Northern Colorado, basically near Boulder, and currently homeless, looking
almost
for a place
homeless. Had some real interesting things, John. We were told that around Thanksgiving that we had to leave the building by the summer. We've been renting for 15 years from them, and then just a couple weeks later, we were told we have to be out in like 50 days.
Oof.
So that's just been a brutal haul during Christmas and stuff. So we managed to get it extended back to summer. So we're looking seriously all over the Front Range, really, from north side of Denver to, just everywhere we can. There's no church buildings around here. There's hardly any churches.
Yep.
And prices are in Denver what they are where you're at. So for a church of 80 to 100 people, it's a challenge.
So if you are in Colorado and you know a place for Doug, reach out for sure. I know there's some places available in the basement of the airport from what I heard. So
I don't know that I want to go down there because some of the stories that I've heard belong more on the Reformed Fringe than they do on Theocast.
I just thought I'd throw that out there for sure. Doug also does a podcast. He and I started a while back called Reformed Fringe. You can go check that out. And you've got quite a few new episodes that are over there. So not why we brought Doug in. Doug's become a dear friend, and he and I started having a conversation about this particular topic, to which he decided to turn it into a book. And I'm really glad he did, because this is going to be very helpful for a lot of pastors Doug, there's been a rise, wrong or right, good or bad. I'm not here to really get into that conversation, but there's been a rise of head coverings in the, I would say, conservative, some reformed, some not. I know of a dispensational Baptist church that has reinstituted head coverings. And there's been a lot of arguments for it. But the passage, and to be clear, this isn't necessarily a passage about head coverings or a podcast about head coverings. I should probably start that off. This is a podcast about 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and understanding kind of its point. But that being said, a lot of people use this particular passage. And so start with this, Doug. Was this something you had preached through? I believe you were preaching through the book of Corinthians when you first started thinking about this.
I actually told our church for the last 20 plus years that I'll never preach the book of 1 Corinthians. Like, this is the most inexplicable book out there. Of all the New Testament
I would say that about Revelation, and you went ahead and wrote a book on it.
Yeah, like Revelation is not a problem to me. 1 Corinthians, crazy problem to
me. Rings of Revelation. Amillennial, just for anybody that might be confused, it's an amillennial perspective of Revelation. It's not a Star Wars theology perspective.
That book is not a Star Wars theology. You know, the slander never ends.
Sorry, that was just really funny when I heard that. I was like, what? Theology of Star Wars? He's amillennial. Did you read the book? Apparently, Doug, you can't use illustrations when you write books because... Anyways, moving on. So how'd this come to be? Like, why 1 Corinthians? What was going on in your mind when you were thinking about putting this together?
I don't know. Maybe a prior question to that, because I don't want to give away quite yet what it's about. But
no, I mean, I don't want you to give it about. Like, but why was it of interest to you? Like, why was it something? Was it just something in the back of your mind?
Like, I wasn't even thinking about it. I was actually preaching through the book of Acts.
Okay.
And there was a verse that showed up in Acts right after Paul leaves Corinth that made me go, huh.
Which is connected to Corinthians. All right, well, leave it there. Yeah. So preaching through Acts, cross-referencing of an event, this is what led you down the road. Because I couldn't remember why you and I were having this conversation a long time ago.
I think that was why. I think it was because I was preaching through Acts at the time and I told you about that verse.
That's right. So for those of you that don't know, 1 Corinthians is dealing with, I mean, there's a lot that's happening in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. But particularly, we are dealing with male headship, authority, and what is appropriate and not appropriate as it relates to prayer and head coverings for women and men and hair and long hair. I mean, there's a lot going on in this particular passage. And I will say, Doug, that when you read 1 Corinthians 11, there's also what I would say one mentions. What I mean by that is Paul will mention something one time and it's never mentioned anywhere else in Scripture. Right? I mean, nowhere else. It's like, this is it.
Absolutely. That's very much the case with this passage.
Right. Right. So historically speaking, there has been a lot of different ways to interpret this. As there are some who believe that, I'll go with kind of the way in which I grew up experiencing some of this, which would be a Baptistic, then Reformed. And then we could kind of jump into how it is that you went from Acts, because I know it's connected, how you went from Acts to Corinthians and then why you brought this book around. But I would say that the predominant view is the one I probably grew up with, Doug, is that it was a cultural issue, that Paul was dealing with the cultural situation, that it wasn't necessarily applicable for the church by and large. He was dealing with a matter that is not necessarily related to a spiritual aspect as much as it was a cultural aspect. That's kind of how I think I grew up hearing it. Later, as probably in the last 4 or 5 years, it's when I read Michael Heiser's view, which is I know others who have had this view that it's related more to a wrong biological view, that basically the woman's fertility is resting in the length of her hair. And so that was what he was referencing, especially when he was talking about the angels. And there's a lot of wild stuff there. We get to each one of these. And then those would probably be only the two that I actually grew up with. Like, there was the cultural, there's the literal view that this is what he wants us to actually practice, that long hair for a man is an abomination, that women need to not shave their heads and they need to wear head coverings. And then the other view, the non-literal view, would be the cultural view. And then the third view would be the fertility view, I think, is the three ones that I would be available, aware of. And I would say the cultural one is probably the most predominant. The literal is on the rise, but it's the lowest view. And I would say the fertility view is definitely on the lowest end of popularity of who would embrace that particular understanding. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's probably fair.
So what are your thoughts about these particular three? Why would you, before we get into your particular view, why do you have a problem? Would you say those are the three? And then if you would, like, where do you struggle with those three?
No, yeah, I think those are the three views. At seminary and at Evangelical Bethel College back in the day, taking Bible classes, they were all for the egalitarian cultural view. Both of those institutions were. And I didn't grow up with that either.
Right.
I'll tell you just personally, I've always had a huge problem with this idea of a cultural view, that you have some sort of a transcendent teaching that becomes a culturally relevant thing. That's strange. Like, how could you have a transcendent teaching that's only culturally relevant to them but not to us? So that kind of actually creates in my mind almost a contradiction. Like, it has to be one or the other. And because I grew up with this as a transcendent teaching, then you bring the egalitarian feminist thing in there and you end up really having a contradiction. And so you have these two sides that are just been battling each other, for decades and decades. It's gotten pretty heated at particular points in my lifetime. Like I said, one of the reasons why I didn't want, I'm almost willing to put this in the past tense, didn't want to preach 1 Corinthians ever, was because of this chapter, because it bothers me that we have such contradictory views of a chapter in the church. And I have my own view in terms of what I think is appropriate. But the church has disagreed on that. So I just didn't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole, basically.
I mean, this is like the guys who come across Reformed passages, Calvinistic passages, and they're like, yeah, I ain't going to deal with that. We're just going to jump into
it. Yeah, I mean, I'll be
honest.
That's kind of the way I am. Like, this is, to me, this is a secondary matter. It's not it's not an issue of the gospel. It's not even an issue of like predestination, which I'll take a firm stand on that kind of thing. It's a matter of how are you supposed to dress when you go to church, and how many churches have been split over that very kind of an idea. And I think that's what you see with a lot of people, the women go and intentionally cut their hair on purpose just to be rebels, or you get the head veil people that come into the church just intentionally in order to kind of make themselves stand out in a congregation where nobody does that. Whatever the case is, it's kind of in some ways very similar attitudes that people will bring into the worship service of a corporate church because of this passage, and that bothers me.
Yeah. Yeah, it has created, I have had family members in the past that have been at churches that made the change. They were not churches that at once held to it, and then they became a church that did. And so it was weird. It was kind of the haves and have-nots, those who really respected the Bible, those who didn't, and eventually they needed to leave the church. That was quite a few years ago. But it created a kind of a weird, because to your point, Doug, the passage doesn't make it sound like it's a matter of conviction, or because the way it was presented to them, now kind of getting off into the weeds, but it's okay. The way it was presented to them, it was like it was a matter of conviction. Like if you really felt like you should do this and you should do it, and if you didn't, so my question always was, we don't do that with anything else in Scripture. If the Bible says this is a sin, like you need to do this. It's like, hey, listen, you are sleeping with your boyfriend. You can't do that. And she says, that's a matter of conviction. I don't have a conviction about that. Well, that's a problem. It's not a matter of conviction. Like, I don't care if you're convicted about it or not. You're not supposed to be doing that. And so if you are, if it's a sin to not wear a head covering or to have short hair or long hair as a man, then we need to uphold that. And then that would require church discipline. Like if you're not, so it's not a matter of, that's what they would say, conscience is what it was, a matter of conscience. Like if your conscience doesn't bother you. And again, I would say, I know why they're doing that, because this is one area where Paul mentions it one time in one particular situation. And so it's hard to like drive down on it hard and require church discipline. Unless you're talking about, you know, we're talking about almost every other conviction that we, like, any passage that I would enact church discipline on, Doug, I have more than one passage to use to help me come to that conclusion.
Yeah.
Like a plethora. But yeah, when this particular one is hard. So I understand why there's it's a matter of the conscience situation. So you're feeling a lot of the same tension, I think a lot of people are, which is why either they go matter of conscience or they go cultural.
But that's the thing, is that it reads like this is not a matter of conscience. Like this, when you read it the way that everybody has kind of read it in my lifetime, you go, well, Paul's giving this doesn't sound at all like some sort of a culturally relative thing that you can just, it's only for the people at Corinth in that particular day, 2000 years ago in that culture. It doesn't read like that.
Well, let's read it just for that case. And for those of you that may have not read it in a while. So there's verses 4 and following, for every man who prays.
Start with verse 2, because I think it's important to start.
Okay. There. Yeah. So 1 Corinthians 11:2. Now I commend you, this is ESV for anybody that's wondering, because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions, even as I delivered them to you. But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of every wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head, but every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, since it is the same as if her head were shaven. I do think it's interesting that he says pray or prophesy in the context of a church. Different conversation, but we'll get into that later. For if a wife will not cover her head, then she should cut her hair short. But since it is disgraceful for a wife to cut off her hair or shave her head, let her cover her head. For a man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Neither was a man created for woman, but a woman for man. So this is, last verse. That is why a wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels.
Because of the angels. Like, where's that come from? Right?
What? All right. So we're dealing with head. So we're dealing with praying and prophesying. We're dealing with structure. So authority. So, and then we're dealing with appropriateness. Like what is appropriate? What is not appropriate? And then we have angels. We'll just go ahead and throw that in there as well. So when you're reading that, it sounds very simple, like simple instructions. Like Paul is just giving you. I'm talking about traditional way of how people read this. It sounds like Paul is just giving you instructions. Here's authority. So Christ is the authority of the man. Man is the authority of the woman. This is the headship of it. This is what is acceptable and what's not acceptable is related to the hair and the covering. And it's all related to praise, a prayer and prophecy. And for some reason, and the angels. So, now, I know, Doug, traditionally some have translated that being messengers. If another messenger from the church comes in, they're not confused as if this woman is under authority or not. Like, is she under a man? If then she's not available to be married. You know, because like we use wedding rings, they used head covers. That was one explanation I've heard. I forgot to throw that in there. Okay.
The reason I had you start in verse 2 is because if you look at verse 2, it says, now I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions even as I delivered them to you. When you go down to verse 17, he says, but in the following instructions, I do not commend you because when you come together, it is not for the better, but for the worst. And so people read the first, I commend you, and they say, oh, well, Paul must be saying that what they're doing here is a good thing. And so therefore he's like, you know, applauding them as he writes those verses. But then as he moves into the next section with the Lord's Supper, all of a sudden he like starts booing them. because they've blown it, you know?
Wait a minute. So you're talking about context matters. Like you need to read an entire context of it. I think I wrote a book.
That's the reason I had you start in verse 2, and we'll come back to that in a minute. So,
but seriously, Doug, how many times does this happen though, where you can read something and you don't read it in its entirety and you miss the actual tone or the purpose or emphasis?
Yeah.
And this is total side note, but this is happening so much right now. It just happens everywhere. Not only in the Bible, happens in our culture. Like there are files that have just come out and people are taking sections of them. And my point is that we as believers should be the ones who are the most stringent about what was the context, what was the purpose, and what was the entirety of what was happening, because Satan is brilliant. If you think about when Jesus is in the wilderness, Satan quotes scripture and he quotes it accurately. He just quotes that out of context. He completely misapplies it. And Jesus puts it right back in its proper context and rebukes him. So this is basically what you're saying. I'm going to steal a little bit of your thunder, is that we have a context issue. Like we're not reading in a context according to your verse 17.
That's what the words say. And so my point is that when it says that I commend you, on a first glance reading, that's what it seems to indicate. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then when it says I don't commend you in verse 17, that's what it seems to indicate there. But there's a bigger context than just those two verses. This does not come out in the middle of thin air. This is like chapter 11 of a very long argument that Paul's been making since the very first chapter with this particular church. And so you can't just pluck even the sections out. You have to read it in the totality of the letter and the tone of the letter that Paul has been writing in since the beginning.
If you're new to Theocast, you may not have heard of this word. It's called pietism. You ever felt like the Christian life is a heavy burden versus rest and joy, that you wake up worrying about how well you're going to perform instead of thinking about what Christ has done for you? It's dread versus joy, really. That's pietism. Pietism causes Christians to look in on themselves and find their hope not in what Christ has done, but what they're doing. And we have a little book for you. It's free. We want you to download it. And we're going to explain the difference between pietism and what we call confessionalism. Reformed theology, really. How it is that we walk by faith, seeing the joy of Christ. And when Jesus says, come to me and I will give you rest, what does that look like? You can download it at our website. Just go to theocast.org. Okay, so let's back up then. We're looking at 17 verses in the middle of an entire book. So talk to us about, if we were to back out and say, okay, where is he at in his argument in this letter? Like, why has he shifted to this?
Well, you know, why he shifts is a kind of a lengthy discussion.
Sure.
I think what's important to recognize here is that Paul has not really had anything good to say about these people at all. Since the beginning of the letter. No. I mean, you can go chapter by chapter and you see that everything that he talks about, whether they're it's factionalism or whether it's a guy sleeping with his mother-in-law or it's their
the Lord's table.
Lawsuits about each other with each other, or, you know, they have no clue about what to do with regard to marriage, or they're eating meat sacrificed to idols. Like, nothing that he has said has been, yay, bravo. It's all been booing. All of it.
Compared to
and
Philippians.
So all of the sudden, you get this verse 2 that says, oh, I applaud you for this. And then it changes again in verse 17. And by the way, once you start in verse 17 and go forward, he, again, has nothing good to say about them for basically the rest of the letter, which puts this one little section of the first half of chapter 17 as completely unique within the context of the whole letter, which is that this is the one thing that he's happy about what they were doing. And to me, it's like when you put together that fact with the fact that the church for 2,000 years has been fighting about this one thing that they're doing right, with literally contradictory interpretations, maybe it's time to scratch our heads and go, maybe we're missing something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is great. I'm glad you pointed this out. So your argument is this, that up to this point in the letter, Paul has, he's responding to all the issues he has heard about.
Yes.
Right. And there's some and big ones
he's not
too.
Stopping that here. Like that.
No.
It's still part of that longer part.
Right. And in his second letter, it gets even worse because I think they get upset about his first letter and their second letter, like, is this guy even an apostle? Should we even trust this guy? I don't think. That's where the whole examine yourself passage comes from. Paul's like, look, if I'm not an apostle, you're not even a Christian. You need to examine yourself. And if you determine you're a Christian, then yes, I'm an apostle. And in, I believe it's 1 Corinthians around this particular area that he's also rebuking them about the abuse of the Lord's table. Is this correct?
So it's literally right after this.
Yeah, right. That's right. Right after this.
And he says in verse 17, but on these matters, I don't, applaud you or whatever. Yep. That's the Lord's Supper section right there.
That's right. So in the flow of the argument, I just want to make sure I'm understanding you correctly. So in the flow of the argument, you're saying Paul is responding to all the areas in which they have not done well. And then some would read, like right in the middle of that, all of a sudden he turns positive, like he's going to sandwich this thing.
Yes.
Negative, negative, positive, negative.
And I don't think some read that. I think almost everybody reads it that way.
No, I do. I agree. And you're arguing that it doesn't necessarily make sense that that's what Paul is doing because it doesn't go with the flow of everything else that he's written
in this section, not in all
of his writing, but in this letter.
In this particular section of the letter, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so then, all right, so if you back up and you're looking at it, he actually starts the chapter with, be imitators of me as I am of Christ. No, I commend you because you remembered me in everything and maintained the traditions even as I delivered them to you. So starting there is basically where this argument begins, right?
Yes.
Okay. So walk us through then. Walk us through how you're thinking to yourself, okay, this isn't necessarily a positive. This is a negative.
Yeah. So this kind of gets back to why I wrote the book and how our first conversation about this came about.
Yeah.
I was preaching through Acts and, it's chapter, 16, 17, 18, somewhere around there that Luke talks about Paul going to Corinth. Mm-hmm. And because it's on the missionary journeys and that's what he's doing. He's telling about where Paul goes on his various places. And then right after he leaves Corinth, Luke gives this throwaway line in Acts 18:18. It says, after this, Paul stayed many days longer in Corinth and then took his leave of the brothers and set sail for Syria with him, Priscilla and Aquila at Cenchreae, which is a seaport not too far away, he had his hair cut because he was under a vow. And I'm reading this, and, the clear context of Acts is that he just came out of a 2-year stay at Corinth.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets his hair cut, and he leaves. And it's like, why in the world do I need to know that Paul got his hair cut?
That's right.
Who
hygiene
cares,
baby.
Right?
Yeah.
So now go to the very beginning of Luke and Acts both, where I think it's Luke where he especially tells us that he's consulting other books as he's writing his histories.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And when you go to when the probable writing of Acts is, it's certainly going to be in the mid-60s, anywhere up to probably the mid-80s AD.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at 1 Corinthians, it's probably written 55 AD.
Okay.
So 1 Corinthians has existed for at least 10 years, maybe 25 years. And my guess is that Luke knows about this book. He probably knows about almost all of Paul's letters, if not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he probably has access to them because he was a friend of Paul who went with him on many of his journeys. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that Luke very likely understands what Paul had written in 1 Corinthians. Now, when you look at the word hair and the whole idea of getting his hair cut, there's only one other place that we learn anything about cutting hair in any of Paul's writings ever. And that's this passage right here.
And that is, just for clarity again, Acts, or you're talking about
in 1 Corinthians 11.
Acts and 1 Corinthians. So those are the two passages.
So Acts 18:18, where Paul gets his hair cut. The only other place we even learn about haircutting at all in Paul's letters is 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And in that passage, Paul says to the men, don't you know that it's a disgrace for a man to have long hair? And this has always bothered me, even on the, you know, even on the kind of the way that I grew up, because I'm like, well, wait a minute. Didn't Samson have long hair?
Mm-hmm.
How could it be a universal disgrace for Paul to say that it's a disgrace for men to have long hair if the Bible itself said that you should take a Nazirite vow, and Samuel had the same vow? He had long hair.
Yeah, it seems like when there's vows, it's more restrictive. Like, they don't touch dead animals, they don't eat certain things, right? It's not
So that kind of leads to the next question, which is, what vow was he under?
That's right.
And so almost all scholars, I write about this in the book, will say that he was under the Nazirite vow, which was the vow that Samson and Samuel were both under.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Nazirite vow, you have three things that you cannot do while you're under the vow. You cannot touch a dead body.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot drink wine, alcohol, touch fermented wine, and you cannot cut your hair. Now, what's so interesting to me about that is that if you look at chapters 8 through 10 of 1 Corinthians, Paul's talking about dead bodies in relation to meat sacrifice to idols. The next section, which is the one we're looking at here, he's talking about cutting your hair. And the next section, he's talking about drinking wine. It's the three parts of the Nazirite vow.
Right.
So
I don't, you may not know this, so I'm going to throw it in the spot, but do you know what the significance behind the Nazirite vow and why Paul would be?
No, in terms of a spiritual significance, I don't really, yeah. I mean, I looked into it. Nobody really seems to have much of a clue as to what it is. It's just a way of being set apart as holy under the prescriptions of ceremonial law, according to Leviticus.
Yeah.
So, you know, whatever God's reasons for those particular things are.
Yeah.
We're not really super.
It is very mysterious. Like, even Samson.
Very mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and people can say what they want to and come up with conclusions about all that. That doesn't really matter too much to me. What interests me more is how you have Paul saying that it's a disgrace for men to have long hair. And yet, if Paul just cut his hair, that means he had long hair for the last 2 years when he was at Corinth.
That's right.
Which means that he's telling the people who literally knew exactly what he looked like, unlike us, because we don't have pictures of him, we didn't know him face to face. They know that when he says, don't you know it's a disgrace for a man to have long hair, that he had long hair. Which means that you've got to figure out a way to interpret that. And I looked through, John, I think I looked through, I forget what it was, 200 different commentaries on 1 Corinthians.
Oof.
I could find almost none that even brought up Acts 18:18.
Really?
I found three kind of, and only one article that explicitly dealt with this. That's it.
Hmm.
And to me, it seems more than slightly relevant, it seems highly relevant to how we should actually then go about interpreting 1 Corinthians 11. Mm-hmm. Because to me, the only way that you can make sense of what Paul is saying there is that he's being sarcastic.
Right. I mean, just to go back, play devil advocate before we let the cat out of the bag here, because I know you're about to. So you just did, but I'm going to pull it back for a second. So what if somebody would say, well, yeah, he had longer hair?
It doesn't matter. Yeah, to me, that the length of the hair, if you get it, you know, that just gets into legalism and pulling out rulers, right? You can't stand 12 inches from the girl when you're dancing, whatever. That's all that is. It doesn't matter if your hair can grow 3 inches or an inch or a foot.
Yeah.
It grew and it was considered long. And by, you know, you look at the old statues of the day with the people in Corinth, those guys in Corinth absolutely believed it was a disgrace for a man to have long hair. it's obvious by the way that they made their icons. Now, that wasn't the case throughout all of the ancient world. The Romans, in some circumstances, believed that it was actually a wonderful thing for man to have long hair. So these are Greek Corinthians with different moral taboos than Romans. So
and to make some arguments here, not only moral taboos, but they were being criticized by Paul for taking on a lot of issues. They had embraced a lot of cultural Corinthian activities, and that's the part of the letter to make your argument, and that this could be seen as one of them, like the issue of the hair. Okay, so you made the statement that this is a reading that is sarcastic.
Sarcastic, yeah.
Yeah, all right. So this is, I remember the day that you called me, and I was like, what are you talking about? Okay, so explain to us then. So far we can see there's an issue. How is it that Paul has long hair? They would have seen him with his long hair. Luke thinks it's important enough to tell us that he cut his hair. So how is it this is, in your mind, a sarcastic reading? Like, let's walk through that.
Okay, well, first let's do a couple of other things before we kind of get to that, which will help set that up. Mm-hmm. The first one is that, would this be unprecedented for Paul to use sarcasm? And the answer is no. In fact, even in this section, there are a couple of verses that some scholars suggest that's sarcasm. Mm. You find this actually running throughout the entire first letter. So, for example, read 1 Corinthians 4, 8 through 10, where he's talking about, already you've become kings. We are fools, but you are wise. He's being sarcastic. 1 Corinthians 5, 2. You are arrogant. Ought you not rather to mourn? Sarcasm. 1 Corinthians 6, 5. Can it be that there is no one among you that's wise enough? Sarcasm. 1 Corinthians 8, 1. All of us possess knowledge. Then twisting it. Sorry, guys, knowledge puffs up. Sarcasm. He does this in Galatians. I wish they'd all go emasculate themselves. Mm-hmm. This is Paul. This seems to be a, when you start looking into it, a kind of a common theme with this guy. he was a rather sarcastic individual.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, the second thing I want to bring up,
very pointed in his language.
He's very pointed. And that, yeah, that kind of leads me to the second thing, which is that evangelicals don't particularly like sarcasm. And I actually asked the AI this just today. I was very curious. I said, why do you think evangelicals don't like sarcasm? And he goes, oh, I have four reasons. It's pretty funny. It says, first of all, we have a purity culture hangover. If your lips are saved, you don't say snarky things.
Purity culture hangover.
This is its words. It said, quote, from the 90s onward, swaths of evangelicals absorbed a hyper nice, Jesus is my boyfriend ethos, always encouraging, always gentle, always earnest. Jesus is gentle, therefore we must be gentle 24/7. Sarcasm registers as aggression, not correction. Sarcasm feels mean-spirited, confrontational, therefore unchristlike in that soft-lit flannel-graph version of Jesus. That's the artificial intelligence telling you that. That's fascinating, man.
Yeah. Well, I don't, you know, most people may not understand, but most of these AI's algorithm is designed to go out and pull the information from the internet.
Right, exactly. So it's reading from the popular culture.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
But dude.
And so there's several other reasons.
Purity culture hangover. Someone needs to write a book called Purity.
I mean, there's several other reasons why evangelicals don't like sarcasm, but I just wanted to kind of bring that out, that we have an aversion to this form of rhetoric that Paul didn't have. In fact, there are entire pieces of ancient literature that the whole thing is sarcastic.
Yeah.
It was a genre.
Because Paul's also the one who talks about, you know, when he writes, let our words be that ones that lift up or build up or not being crude with our language. So yes. Your point being is that there is a place for sarcasm. And it exposes you in a way you're like, oh, ouch. Yeah, I guess he's right. Like that was.
Yeah. What's better to say for Elijah to tell the Baals Where's your God? Is he going to the bathroom? Which is exactly what Elijah says to the Baals on Mount Carmel.
That's right.
Or for him to just kind of keep his mouth shut and say, well, I can't say anything mean because I'm a Christian.
Well, he's exposing the absurdity without being crude.
Yes.
And without being sinful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because sometimes, like, I will say this. I see some people who are sarcastic and they're only sarcastic. And they're sarcastic to a point where I'm like, that's actually not helpful. You're just being a jerk. Like that's, I don't agree with that. But sarcasm used appropriately could work as a sting, and it needs to work as a sting of like, oh, ow, that kind of stings.
It's like, exactly. Good. And yeah, I mean, I certainly understand the point that, you know, even preachers can use sarcasm in very bad ways to humiliate people from a pulpit.
Yep.
And that's right. Not what Paul is doing.
No.
So sarcasm can, it's a weapon, right? It can be used for good or for bad. Mm-hmm. And I think that what's happening throughout 1 Corinthians is that Paul is using it to expose the hypocrisy and the outward appearance fascination that these people have. And I actually think that this part of chapter 11 may be the epicenter of all of his sarcasm, which is the exact opposite reading that almost everybody else has taken.
Hey, Doug, to jump in real quick, because Paul deals with other passages, but he feels like he's extremely sarcastic here. Is it when it feels like when there's obvious error, like this is a massive obvious error, is when the level of sarcasm comes up on Paul. Like this is so obvious. I'm going to make a joke about this because it's so bad.
Yeah, exactly. It exposes the absurdity of it.
Yeah.
So and the reason why I point that out because that's helpful. Should we go through this and read it as sarcasm? So I actually have a sarcastic translation of 1 Corinthians 11, 2 through 16. Now, not every verse is sarcasm, but most of them are. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of how I read it. Verse 2. Now I commend you for remembering me. Well done. Now, this is one of those few places that I believe at that moment, he's actually being dead serious. Mm-hmm. You have remembered me. Well done. But immediately my translation says, but in everything? Really now? Given all we've seen so far, the divisions, lawsuits, immorality, I'm not so sure about that. As for maintaining the traditions, just as I delivered them to you, let's just say you're not quite there, are you? So it starts at the serious foundation here in verse 3. The real verse says, but I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ and the head of a wife is her husband. The head of Christ is God. So here's my translation of this. I take that very seriously. This is not sarcastic. So I really want you to understand this foundational tradition, since you're clearly missing the point, guys, that the head of every husband is Christ. The head of a wife is her husband. The head of Christ is God. That's your true covering, not some piece of cloth, obviously. Worship should honor him, not your cultural rules, shouldn't it? So I'm already kind of giving away in my my targuming there, my midrashing.
That's okay. We're 40 minutes in, so we got to get there soon anyways.
How we're doing this. So verse 4, now he starts getting snarky. So every husband who prays or prophesies with a veil dangling over his head, oh, the horror, he dishonors his head. Christ, all because he doesn't look manly enough for Corinth, right? So the Romans actually covered their heads when they prayed, the Roman men. Corinthian men didn't. Verse 5, but every wife who prays or prophesies with her head unveiled, she dishonors her, quote, head, her husband. Not God, but her husband. You see, there's things going on in the text here between the heads. Mm-hmm. Who's the head?
Christ.
Okay, so she dishonors her head, her husband. Why? It's practically as if she shaved it all off, Zeus forbid. As if her lack of a veil is the real scandal here in the church full of divisions and immorality. What I'm trying to expose there is that the Corinthians were obsessed with outward behavior, appearances. And this is the epicenter of it. When they come together to worship, how do you look? Meanwhile, they couldn't care less about the immorality, the lawsuits, none of it. And so I think what Paul is doing is sarcastically exposing the hypocrisy.
No, I'm going to jump ahead. Go ahead. Keep going.
Okay. Verse 7, for a husband obviously shouldn't cover his head since he's the image and glory of God, right? But the wife, well, she's the glory of man. What a perfect excuse to fuss over veils while ignoring all the immorality in your worship, isn't it? Verse 8, it's not like man came from woman. Oh, wait, no, it's the other way around. Woman came from man, naturally. So that's why you're obsessed with veils, to make it all about appearances while turning a blind eye to your moral failures, huh? Real nice. God would certainly be pleased. In that instance, what he's doing is he's twisting around something that's true, or he's showing that they're twisting around something that's true, which is the order of creation, a man and a woman, and they're using it to justify hypocrisy. Verse 9, and man wasn't created for woman, but woman from man. How perfect. What a great reason to make it all about veils and status instead of unity, isn't it? As if creation was all about showing off the sexes in worship. Verse 10, that's why a wife ought to have authority on her head, because of the angels. Naturally, a little veil will surely stop those randy fallen ones from pouncing like Zeus on a mortal. So there's your angel idea there, where what I'm suggesting in that one is essentially that they actually agreed with the supernatural translation. You don't have to take it that way. I actually have an alternative translation there, but let's say that they took it the way everybody else did. And they're like, oh yeah, the angels, they look after women. And what they were doing was basically saying, if you put a veil on your head, then Zeus won't be able to do anything to you. Now you got to understand, this is a highly paganized culture. Like they have I forget what the goddess was that they have on top of the hill at the top of the,
is it a Diana or the, I'll think of it in a minute. Go ahead.
Yeah. I can't remember. It might be Aphrodite actually, which Aphrodite, would be all the prince in the world, because she's like this goddess of lust. So, you know, there you would have almost like superstition coming in, where it's not your head, Christ, Jesus himself, who's the one who protects you. It's the veil on your head.
Okay. So by the way, probably in my opinion, the only other strange verse from Paul's when he talks about baptism for the dead. Besides that, this one here, for the sake of the angels.
I haven't figured that one out yet, so maybe I'll go with the sarcasm thing for that one too.
Might be. Mormons use it. Okay, so for seriously though, for the sake of angels, that's when you were going through this whole thing, and I'm like, okay, that makes sense, because he never explains it. He acts as if we should know what he means. I mean, literally. Yeah. Like there are Paul does this all the time, and I'm okay with it, because Paul will make a reference and it's like, oh, if you know the Old Testament, then you know what he means. He doesn't need to explain it, right?
Right.
But in this sense, he's like, what in the world do you mean by that, for the sake of the angels?
Yeah, and I think all he's doing there is he's just exposing the fact that, okay, maybe these guys, you know, if we were doing this on the Reformed Fringe instead of Theocast, we could talk about that a little bit more, right?
Yeah.
But maybe what he's doing is he's saying, okay, you guys really like to talk about the fallen angels, and you love Nephilim talk. How's the head veil thing going to save you from any of that, basically? It's just an extra little jab.
Sure.
I want to go back to the head covering thing for a minute, because you brought this up. This was Heiser brought this up in his view. It comes from a paper that was written about 10 years ago on pardon my French, it's the title of the article, but the article is basically, is it a head covering or a testicle? And when people first hear this, they're like, what in the world are you talking about? Mm-hmm. Well, the article goes to some of the old Greek physicians, okay? And says that basically in the science of their day, they believed that hair was hollow, and so it acted like a tube that would like suck up the male seed when they were pregnant. And so to have long hair for a woman would actually help her get pregnant. And then it would be the opposite for a man. So the whole argument is arguing that Paul is using the science of his day to make this argument. And it's a kind of a form of a cultural argument as opposed to a transcendent argument.
Right.
But because of that, that's never set well with me either. And yet I haven't been able to argue against it. I'm like, well, that's literally what the scientists did. That's what they believed. I can't disagree with that. But now on a sarcastic reading, it basically flips that on its head too.
It does. It's like, really? Is this really what you believe?
So, yeah, it's like, it's a really wild thing, John, to read most of this sarcastically. Now, I don't read verse 11 and 12 sarcastically. I read that very seriously here. So,
right.
But let's get serious for a moment. Verse 11, in sure. The Lord, neither woman exists apart from man, nor man apart from woman. For just as woman came from man, so also man comes through a woman. And all things come from God, the creator of all. He is our covering. That's my translation of it. And then from there on out, he just starts to nail them again. Judge for yourselves. Oh, wait, you already have, haven't you? Is it proper for a wife to pray to God with her head unveiled? Because obviously that's the biggest issue in your worship, right? Stay tuned. Doesn't nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it's a disgrace? Because hair length determines your devotion to God, doesn't it? Clearly I missed the memo. And that's my key verse there. And I think what's happened here, John, is that when Paul got to Corinth, that some point early on, he realized what kind of people these were. Mm-hmm. And he realized that there were some very specific issues in the church that if he took a Nazarite vow, it would serve as a counter to their hypocrisy. Mm. So in other words, he wasn't able to touch meat sacrifice to idols. And yet he turns around and says, a meat sacrifice on idols is nothing. He wasn't able to cut his hair. And in this passage, he's mocking them because that's all they care about is their external appearances. And then finally, he probably wasn't even able to take wine in communion, if you think about it. Mm-hmm. It. Not the way that we think about it, because he was under a vow. He couldn't take alcohol. Mm-hmm. And yet, what did they do in the next section? Well, you guys are getting drunk. Mm-hmm. And you're using it as an excuse to beat up your brothers. And so basically what I'm arguing for is that this passage is the height of what they're doing wrong as opposed to what they're doing right. And when Paul says, you know, I commend you for all this stuff, he's actually being as snarky as can be.
Right. Like, I commend you for following what I've told you, except for in these areas.
Except for here, right? And basically when he says, thank you for following the traditions, but I haven't told you any of what they are, and really you haven't really done much of any.
No.
And especially not in this instance. And then he starts talking about the way that they worship.
Right.
You know, people, this has struck me. I don't know what you think about this, but for many years, I've never understood this. If an entire segment of Christianity in the charismatic world, the Pentecostal world, that like uses 1 Corinthians as the benchmark of how you're supposed to be worshiping God. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, but this is the most messed up church that there is in terms of how you worship God.
Are you talking about like the spiritual gifts?
Yeah, the spiritual gifts, the tongues, the whole way that like in those circles, this becomes, 1 Corinthians 12. What does 1 Corinthians 14 say? And it's like, well, those are the only two places in all of Paul's letters that even talks about this. It's the same thing we're talking about with this, right?
Right.
It's just very interesting to me.
Right.
And yeah, I think the same thing is showing itself with the way that we've been fighting over how to interpret this passage for so long, when the fact of the matter is there is at least some sarcasm here. Many have seen that. And when you actually read the whole thing sarcastically, except for the couple of verses that are actually grounding the theology that allows him to be even more snarky, It actually answers every single question that this crazy heated debate has been fighting over for decades.
That's right.
It's wild. Yeah,
I think that's why it's important too. Like when you're reading scripture, you have to read it not only in its context. Like, okay, what is the Corinthians saying? But what's happening in the broader church? Like, what's going on in the city? Where is Paul in his journeys? Like, basically, this is what you've done is say, okay, here's the letter. Why would Paul say it this way? So you back way out and you're like, well, he has been slapping them upside the head about everything. And all of a sudden he's going to stop and give one church, one specific instruction that is related to no other church and no other apostle. No one even alludes to this kind of stuff. Not even now the headship and authority and all of that. That is where we can confirm multiple times in scripture. We talk about, The structure of the home, that is not obscure at all.
Right. So
let's just be clear.
And that's why I said that those are the things that are actually repeated, aren't they? The headship stuff. Mm-hmm. That's repeated in other places. And so that becomes the grounding logic for what they should be doing. But he uses that grounding logic not to really reinforce that, but to point them to Christ as the head
and
God is their covering. You know what I mean? That they're fighting over all these external things, and they're doing the very same thing here that they've been doing with every other issue that he's brought up, which is they're just simply ignoring the moral requirements that God gives them for how they're supposed to be behaving towards one another.
Yeah, I can remember. So I grew up in a tradition where women were not to wear pants. It was a sin. Only men could wear pants, but women could not. And, I remember as a little kid when I started seeing my mom move, like I remember the first time she wore pants and I saw her walked out of the, I was like, what are you wearing? What's up with that? And it was, I can remember when my dad started to move away from all of those cultural pressures, but it was a part of this cultural pressure that this is the way that men dress and this is the way that women dress and it has to be separated in this way. And when the argument you're making is the Corinthians are doing the same thing.
They're doing, that's exactly right. They're doing identical thing. And so to me, when you think about the application of this, and you brought up earlier how we're seeing a rise in the wearing of head coverings, at least in some conservative circles, whereas you're seeing a rise in the exact opposite in more liberal circles or some evangelical circles where women are dressing however they want, flaunting what they got, kind of stuff. And it's like, there is obviously modesty and that kind of stuff is always-
A degradation of the home, of the structure of the home,
and
of the offices, like women can hold all the offices. I mean, there is an absolute direction in either, like a split in either direction.
100%, 100%. What I think about at least the head covering issue itself, based on my reading of 1 Corinthians, is that I think that Paul would say it's ideophora. It's a matter of indifference. It's a matter of what does your own conscience tell you that you should do, and you should do that, and your brothers are not supposed to be judging you for your own conscience on matters of indifference. This is Romans 14 sort of stuff. But because the Colossians Corinthians too are not treating it that way, and they're actually treating this as primary instead of secondary, as this is essential stuff, Paul gets absolutely furious with the legalism, and he just goes to town on them by the use of sarcasm.
Well, it makes sense because he does it in Galatians as well. Who bewitched you? And he gets really angry. Or those who are adding to the law, I wish they would emasculate themselves. So as you're reading through this, like, oh, I can't believe the long hair and sick for the angels. So that's how you're arguing how Paul is really coming after him. Like, what? Why are you creating these obligations on these married people? That's
exactly right. And so you can turn a matter that's secondary into a matter that's primary. You can make a secondary issue a primary issue. You can make it almost an issue of salvation. And whenever the gospel, whenever Paul encounters people that do that, he gets absolutely incensed because there's only one gospel and you cannot replace it with the law, whether it's a good law or bad law, whether you made it up, whether it's found in Moses or Jesus, it doesn't matter. The law is not the gospel. And these people are behaving almost as if the head covering issue is the gospel for them in the way that they meet.
I don't know if you cover this in the book, but I'll bring this up now. Anytime you do interpretation and you're dealing with a particular situation where a passage is complicated, the rule of thumb is to go where it's clear and interpret it in light of the clarity, in light of the unclear. So we can go to passages where multiple times Paul is talking about the structure of how things are to function in a church and marriage, and they're not unclear. They're very clear. And you bring those understandings into Corinthians, you're going to say, well, the clarity is not like these, the head covering and angels don't fit where he's talked about it in the past. And so the only other time we're worried about the angels, and I don't think he means messengers, is actually not Paul, unless whoever you can take the interpretation of Hebrews is, but he's like, there's the angels among you, unaware, so be hospitable to all. I think your argument's Luke, right? It's Luke that wrote that. Anyways,
that's actually David Allen who says that in his NAC commentary on that. But
fine.
So I didn't actually invent that idea. It's been around for a while.
Throw the authority out there. That's fine.
I don't want to be the authority on who wrote Hebrews, since I think it was Origen who said only God knows who wrote Hebrews.
Right. So to your defense and to your argument and just proper hermeneutics for those who are thinking about this, it's good and right to go, okay, where else does Paul talk about marriage? Where does he talk about authority? What's the structure? Where else does he talk about Christ being the head of man? Well, we got a lot of passages to talk about that. And you can go to Ephesians for that, Colossians that talks about that. So we have abundance of clarity of that. And then in this particular area, it goes sideways. You have to ask yourself, why did it go sideways? And to bring this all to a close, you're saying in the flow of the letter, it's negative, and he's used sarcasm, and this is another area where cultural sway has moved the church off of Christ for them, the emphasis of Christ, Christ they're covering, God they're covering, and he's just exposing it through sarcasm. Is the kind of to wrap the it all up.
That, which is that in one way, both of the arguments that have taken this as either transcendent or cultural, the Corinthians are actually using both of those in the wrong way. So they're taking the transcendent ideas, which are the grounding theological truths that aren't being sarcastic, and then they're using it to make a transcendent idea of how everybody is supposed to worship in their church. Mm-hmm. But that is itself coming from a Corinthian idea of how people are supposed to be worshiping.
That's right.
As they refuse to look at how the Romans worshiped and say, oh, well, maybe there's a different way that people do it. So it's strangely ironic. And actually, in not seeing the sarcasm, I kind of make the argument near the end of the book that we're actually kind of becoming prone to the very thing that the Corinthians themselves were being prone to. Mm-hmm. And we're making this an issue that is exactly what they were turning it into. Mm-hmm. And we're not seeing what Paul is actually trying to tell them. Mm-hmm.
Well, I know if you've ever read Doug's books, they are well documented. They're not short, and that's a compliment.
This one's not terribly long. It's only, you know, 1 Corinthians 11, first half of it. So how long can it be?
I don't know. I've never seen a short book of yours. Your Five Solas is the smallest book I've ever seen. Anyways, if you are interested, you can go to DouglasVanDoren.com or go to Amazon, which is where most of Doug's books are. You can go to Amazon.com and, well, that's weird saying that. Go to Amazon.com to buy his book. Just look up Doug's name. By the time this comes out, most likely it'll be there. It'll be there
it
soon.
It should be there. Yes, I will. Yeah. I will. If you put this out in a couple of weeks, it will be there.
All right. Well, we'll make sure we time it coming out by the time that it's there. So go to Amazon.com and support.
It's called called Raising Hair. I love the title. So,
but you have to explain how it's spelled though.
Yes, it's R-A-Z-I-N-G. So raising hair is obviously kind of, right, that's a euphemism of causing trouble.
Yep.
But it's raising, so it's tearing down.
Yep.
And hair is the hair in the story. So it's like cutting the hair. And there's all kinds of fun things that I think that the title evokes in my mind anyway. So,
yep. Yep. Well, a longer episode, and hopefully this is, I'm hoping pastors listen to this, especially those who are going to have to preach it. You should get the book, hear his arguments. And Doug and I are both going to say, look, if you don't agree with our arguments, you could be in our church. We are totally okay with it. This is a tertiary matter. I do appreciate the exegesis and the thought put into this, thinking about where Paul is at, what else has Paul said, what is going on in his life, and how is he talking to the Corinthians. This is just a good lesson on how to interpret hard passages. You should get the book for that, let alone just thinking about how to interpret a hard, complicated passage. So, yeah, good times, Doug. Well, thanks for coming on. And your first episode on Theocast. Let's go ahead and just pick the most complicated passage in all of the Bible.
Finally having me on Theocast.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome. All right. Well, thanks for listening. If you want to learn more about Doug, go to douglasvandoorne.com. You can. He's been a Reformed Baptist pastor for over 25 years.
The church is, let's say that too, the rbcnc.com. So it's Reformed Baptist Church of Northern Colorado. You can get all our sermons there and find our address. We will update the address as soon as we move.
Know where they're going.
For now, we're at the place it says.
Yeah. You can check out Doug's other books. He's done one on covenant theology, the five solas, baptism, on the angel of the Lord. There's a plethora of great books there. You can go check them out. All right. Thanks, Doug. And God bless you. We just pray that the Lord will find a place. I know what it's like to be a church planner or have a small church and not have a building. It's like having a family without a house. It's very stressful. So may the Lord give you strength and as you wait for his provision. So thanks, brother.
Thanks, man.
Hey guys, real quick, some of you are listening to this and it's encouraging to you, but you have questions. So where do you go? How do you interact with other people who have the same questions and share resources? We have started something called the Theocast Community, and we're excited because not only is it a place for you to connect with other like-minded believers, all of our resources are there, past podcasts, education materials, articles, all of it's there, and you can share it and ask questions. You can go check it out. The link is in the description below.